Okay, so I'm gonna try to move pretty quick. Then to get to the plasticity and to the stuff at the end. I think we've already touched on this. There's a current called IH, hyperpolarization activated inward current. A lot of it's on at rest. There's about 10-fold higher density in the distal dendrites in the CA1 cell, 50-fold higher in layer 5 cells. There's just a huge standing inward conductance through these channels. And these channels turn off, and when they turn off, they shift the standing membrane conductance closer to potassium, or more in favor of potassium, and this produces a sort of outward current in effect. And so it has a tendency to produce a reduction in the duration of the half-width of an EPSP by turning off. Then this moves, this hyperpolarizes the membrane. So you have a sort of outward current that's turned on during depolarization. And this tends to, as I was telling Chuck earlier, reduce the distance-dependent increase in the duration of a single EPSP, and then remove the location dependence of temporal summation. Okay, this has been out for a long time. And then more recently from the Johnson lab, if you guys are interested in this, this increase in IH density produces a kind of inductance and enhances and produces a resonance peak of the dendrites so that they resonate faster and stronger around 7 hertz than if you gave the same sine wave input to a soma. Okay, so, you know, then the point is to try to lump all these things together and see how it affects the integration of synaptic input and what sort of overall depolarization is produced within the cell. Okay, 4 different styles, different patterns of input. In this case, we're going to be using electrodes, so it's all going to be in one spot in space, so it's still going to be clustered. But we're going to spread it out in time or, again, give a very synchronous input. So if we start at the bottom and we give couple hundred inputs, starting from maybe 50 up to a few hundred over a time window of 50 milliseconds. So the interval for these little unitary conductance changes is random between 0 and 50. And when you increase the number of inputs in there, you gradually increase, progressively increase the amount of depolarization that you get at the dendrite. And this is in over a population is an extremely linear function. Okay.
And how would that be if you plotted it as a function of charge transfer? Because that's maybe the more relevant physiological thing.
So this is. That's a good question, Chuck, and I can't do it in my head, but I'm going to say it would be the same.
Go up.
Yeah.
Make it curve up.
Maybe it would. I'm basically integrating, I'm averaging over the last 10 milliseconds of this thing. So there is a curve to it. But I think it would still, you know, there would be more, obviously, but I think it would still be linear. This is a substantial amount of peak depolarization, and we should have a good deal of driving force loss, but no. And the reason for this is there's a lot of voltage gated and agonist gated ion channels that are counterbalancing each other off to produce this sort of active linearization of the local input-output function. So if we get rid of the NMDA receptors, like I've already shown you, then this loss of driving force starts to show up. If we get rid of the H channels, then everything sort of scales up. And if we get rid of these potassium channels, then we'll start to fire off, if we give it a little more synchronously, we'll start to fire off a local sodium spike within the dendrite. So we'll move completely out of this linear mode. So again, this is a balancing of all these different conductances to produce this kind of linear integration mode for asynchronous type of inputs. It actually can be asynchronous or spread out in space. They both do the same thing. Now, if we synchronize all the input and put it at the same place in space, then we can see as we increase the amount of current, you don't have to do it all within a 1 millisecond time window. It can be up to 10 milliseconds in these cells. You'll see that eventually you hit a threshold. It gets more and more depolarization. You hit a threshold and a local sodium spike, this is TTX sensitive, occurs, and you get this nice sort of S-shaped sigmoid type of nonlinear type of input-output function. Okay, this is dependent in CA1 cells on sodium, voltage-gated sodium channels. And again, if you toy with the mix of sodium and potassium currents, you can shift both the threshold and the amplitude of the nonlinearity. Okay, so same cell, same dendrite, same everything. All we did was synchronize up the input, give it all very briefly, and we completely converted from a linear to a nonlinear type of integration. Yes. This is at the dendrite. I think the next slide has something about the soma, so it'll show you what it, how it showed up at the soma. Yeah.
Jeff, but looking just at the peak amplitude in millivolts, it seems that the nonlinearity transition happens around 40 in the upper plot, but the lower plot ends at 40. So it could be that you have the same nonlinearity if you kept that in inputs even asynchronously. Is that correct?
It should be around 30.
Okay.
And this should go up a little bit more. We intentionally tried to cross the threshold to just make that point. And the deal is that so we have crossed the threshold. As you integrate slowly, and for the asynchronous inputs, the sodium channels are inactivating, the K channels are activating, and this threshold is moving higher and higher. Okay, so you can get this if you just pile on more and more current, but for up to like 10 milliseconds or so, but the threshold creeps up and creeps up. Eventually, you're depolarizing so slowly here that the threshold you never reach the threshold. You eventually reach this calcium plateau potential thing that happens, at about 50 millivolts with the depolarization. So it's changing. You're almost chasing your tail with a slower asynchronous input. This will happen. I'll show you in the branches, in the side branches, and this thing will semi-actively propagate to the soma. I also showed you that there's this impedance mismatching and loading that makes this propagation unfavorable. But in some cases, these will show up strong enough to fire an action potential output. Good question. Peak voltage at the local input site is about 60, and then it filters down, propagates down to about 10 millivolts. Yes. I'm sorry, maybe I don't get the question. Ask me again. Here. Here. 30 to 60 is about half. Oh, plus, I'm sorry, that's amplitude, not absolute voltage. No, no, so that's like zero. That's like zero. It doesn't go, it doesn't ever go above zero. Yeah, yeah. So in some sense, the conductances will not allow this to go above zero because they'll still be on somewhat here. Or it's just not, there's just a lot of K conductance actually. So if you get rid of that K conductance, then you can actually creep up above zero. This is about 75, I think. Oh no, this is not right. So I should have made that point earlier. Because of this mix of potassium and sodium channel densities and the sort of non-isopotentiality of the compartments, these are not all or none action potentials like in what we think of in the axon, okay? And the dendrites just aren't excitable enough to do that. And that's why they sort of decrement and while they backpropagate, and they severely decrement when they forward propagate. And that's why we call them spikes and not action potentials. You've already seen this, but I just wanted to show you that we can quantify what the type of input pattern is required to produce that local sodium spike that I just showed you. It takes a unique input pattern, like I said, that's highly correlated in time and synchronous, and in this case, a space, okay? So you have to have all of this input onto one of these radial oblique branches, one of these terminal branches, which are about 150 microns long. They become essentially one electrical compartment so that the filtering within that branch isn't great enough to really have any input have a less effect than another input. And it turns out then in the end that you need about 30 inputs within about 10 milliseconds onto a single branch within the CA1 cells to get this. Now Jackie will go into the properties of the NMDA spikes in other cells, and I think there's probably less needed, and a time window, since these are slow events, is spread out. Okay, so this is as highly correlated in space and time of dendritic nonlinearity that I've ever come across, and this is probably a unique specialization for this cell. Just to drive that home a little further, there are other mechanisms which can produce these S-shaped curves. Jackie discovered this one, and she'll go all into that. And but you know, in the end, there's also I sort of showed you this before, this dendritic plateau potential that's initiated out in the distal parts of all pyramidal cells. This is a sort of mix of voltage-gated calcium channels and NMDA receptors. And in the end, they all sort of have a different effect on output. Hopefully that's the next. So we can have what is essentially three very different modes of output that are produced by these three different modes of integration, which are produced by these three different patterns of synaptic input. Same cells. You can, on one hand, have this linear integration mode for the asynchronous input that, as you get more and more synaptic input into the cell, this propagates down to the soma to produce more and more action potentials over the same time window. This is sort of the classic integrate and fire neuron that most people use in their models. And it's essentially the neuron as Geiger counter, where it's summing up, just counting the numbers of inputs that it received and producing a rate or frequency change dependent upon that. You can also, if you produce one of these local sodium spikes, these things generally propagate well to the soma, or they, at least they can, and when they do, they sort of supercharge the axon region, and they produce this very precise action potential output. for input levels that are about four times smaller than what would have been required without the sodium spikes. It's a big boost, and it produces a very precise action potential output. It may be important for these different types of coding. And in the end, since it's produced by this very specific, highly correlated input pattern, it's the cell essentially looking for particular stimulus features. Okay, it's looking for the input that's coming in at the same time onto one branch. And when that happens, it fires off this strong sodium spike that then can actively, semi-actively propagate to the cell and cause an output. Okay, something another way the cell can work is by producing these distal calcium plateau potentials in the tuft of the cell. And I'm going to talk a lot about these for the rest of the talk, or for some parts of the talk. And that is when you get input to both the proximal part of the cell and to the distal part of the cell so that you get action potentials generated along with distal arbor depolarization. You'll produce one of these plateau potentials, calcium plateau potentials, which propagates to the soma to produce a burst of action potential output. Okay, so you have a completely third different mode. Yes.
So the first two are generated for all neurons. The last one is only for parameter C5, C1.
So I would never tell you anything that was general for all neurons. Course, right? So, I mean, there are many cells, people believe, and I've seen a few examples myself, who pretty much always do this, okay? So granule cells in the hippocampus seem to be all stuck in this linear mode. Maybe layer 4 cells in the neocortex. Only CA1 cells do this with a sodium spike, okay? Many other pyramidal cells do this with a slower NMDA spike, okay? So the exact mechanisms of this can vary from cell type to cell type. Only pyramidal cells do this that I know of.
Only
pyramidal
cells, only neophyte?
Oh no, I think all of them do.
Okay. I think what you have to have here is a coincidence of activation between pathways.
Yes.
And the ionic mechanism for those things. So if you had these two, this would happen. You have only one of them, you have to have a mechanism.
Yeah, that's right.
So calcium spike, sodium spike, or NMDA spike, or all of them. But in order for that to happen, you have to have a coincidence in time and in space as well.
Yes. That's
so
right.
This is favorably happening in the tuft, right? Mm-hmm. In the tuft of pyramidal neurons. But it might be in other neurons, like Purkinje maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think certainly Purkinje cells can fire calcium plateaus in their dendrites, and that produces a burst output as well. But I guess that's sort of a coincidence detection as well between the climbing fibers and whatever the other parallel fibers. You can see things which suggest that there are sodium spikes going off in the tuft, and you can imagine that if what's going on here is this sum of these very large local depolarizations are required in order to get to this calcium plateau threshold, which is pretty high. Any booster will help. Okay,
I don't. It's the same volume. Yes. The only difference is the degree of spread.
Inter-region.
Yeah. So in the layer 5 cells, you know, this is what happens. These backpropagating spikes summate on top of each other, and on whatever dendritic depolarization you have going on, it hits the calcium plateau threshold, and then that propagates to the soma to keep the thing going around more spikes. And I'm not going to have time, but I wanted to show you a sort of behavioral in vivo look at these things in layer 5 cells. Yes?
Sorry, just a quick question. Can you say again what red line and black line are?
Here?
Yeah, on the left.
Here, these are all from the soma. Okay.
So what's the difference between red and black on the line?
Black is the lowest threshold, just threshold level of current injections here.
Oh.
And red is higher.
But it's recorded as a sum.
Recorded simultaneously at the soma. So this one and that black one go together.
Jeff, how come you don't see any after hyperpolarizations on those spikes? They must have been generated someplace other than the soma.
Here?
Yeah. No, down below.
Well, that's right. They're generated in the axon, but the true answer is the potassium gluconate that we use blocks a little bit of our KCA channel.
It's usually you see pretty big after hyperpolarization for the soma recording.
Well, yeah. So there's, you know, it's there, but it should kind of probably come down twice that. And with these two electrodes, you really dialyze the cell a lot and just get rid of the fast AHP. You can use another one and increase it. That's your choices. Yes. Say again. These are calcium, but in these cells where this was recorded in CA1, if you you can block these by blocking NMDA receptors or R-type calcium channels. I think Jackie's published something similar, at least that cadmium does as much as APV. So there seems to be a mix. And certainly it helps if you've got real synaptic input as opposed to current. But in layer 5 cells, there's a lot more voltage-gated calcium channels, and you can get a nice plateau with just injecting current. CA1 doesn't really like to do that. So, I mean, this is pretty important, I think, and fundamental point that these cells can, because of their dendritic properties, produce at least 3 vastly different computations, depending upon what type of input that they receive. Okay, so I'll try to quickly go over this this idea that you can also use the excitability of the dendrites and all the properties of the dendrites to store information. We sort of stumbled on this new form of plasticity that really, in this case, doesn't have much to do with synaptic properties. It's basically all a change in excitability of individual dendritic branches. So what we noticed when we were doing these studies, looking at what types of input patterns are required to initiate sodium spikes in these different terminal branches of the branches around the soma, the proximal radial oblique and the basal dendrites, we noticed that most of them, if you record at the soma, the spike that's generated is barely visible at the soma, almost no reflection of what's happened in the dendrite. Well, you can image out here and you can see a nice step increase at a certain threshold, like here, of a calcium signal, so you know the thing's gone off. That calcium signal's TTX sensitive. What you see at the soma is essentially nothing. Okay? And on the other hand, about 10% of the branches within the same cell, you could see a very large reflection at the soma. So there was a large strength, a branch strength variability that we encountered in individual cells and across the population. Most of them were weak, some of them were strong. The strong ones were capable of producing this form of action potential output that I showed you. The weak ones could not. You had to sum multiple branches together to get the cell to fire action potentials, and it gave this sloppy sort of pattern. So we thought maybe there's some sort of plasticity involved in this, and so we cut slices, and that some of the branches are strong and some of the branches are weak. So we wanted to kind of look at this a little bit more carefully then. And this is a sort of common feature amongst these parts of the arbor, whether it's these radial obliques or basal branches. It's this sort of Y thing where there's a parent and a couple of daughters, usually only 2. And what we saw was that in the end, that there's a sort of saltatory-like propagation of these local sodium spikes through the arbor. Okay, so that if you uncaged and caused the, if you uncaged on and caused this parent branch to fire a sodium spikelet, you could see the spikelet at the soma here. If we take the temporal derivative, you can see that it's of this sort of amplitude. And then if you went to another branch, this blue one, and you did the same thing, then you would see that it showed a very small spikelet that was much smaller than the parent. And if you went to the other daughter, you would see that you again uncaged on that one, and it produced an action a spikelet whose DVDT looked like a combination of this daughter component and the parent branch, but was essentially the same size as the parent sodium spikelet that propagated in. Okay, and this led us to believe that there was something essentially different about the strength, the propagation strength of these two branches, so that this one was strong enough to propagate the spike all the way down and fire the parent off. That propagated to the soma, axon, fired the axon off, and away you went. This one, on the other hand, fired a local spike, but it wasn't capable of propagating well enough to reach the threshold of the parent branch. And that's what's shown here. Michaela was able to produce a model, and essentially all you needed to do was change the density of this A-type potassium channel by 2 or 3 fold, and you could go from strong propagating to weak. So that, we think, is the mechanism of these things, and it's possible then that the weak branches have a higher density of, or at least a higher functional effect of potassium channels than the strong branches. And we thought, if it were true that what we saw, just this variability in us that was just there in the slices, then maybe we should be able to give some sort of LTP-like paradigm protocol that could cause the excitability of that branch to increase, and then it should be able, a weak branch, to increase so that it could be able to then fire off a strong parent. And that's what we did. We gave what is essentially, we found two different protocols that work. One is the sort of classical theta pairing protocol, where we gave repetitive local uncaging here paired with back propagating action potentials. And when we did this 15 times, we saw that the strength of the daughter branch increased enough so that it could fire the parent off and therefore give a strong spikelet at the soma. So here's the experiment. We test the parent branch. We see that it's strong. Here's the DVDT of the parent. Here's the weak EPSP that shows up at the soma for uncaging on a weak daughter, and the derivative is very small. And then we give this pairing protocol, and the derivative of this little thing here starts to creep up in time. And all of a sudden, it hits some threshold after about 30 minutes, and it begins to look a lot more like the parent branch DVDT. Okay, so we have our local component and then the parent, and we have about a almost 10-fold increase in this DVDT amplitude from before and after the pairing protocol. Yes?
So you said that these branches, the daughters, is generic. And if these are pair of a strong, weak, also generic? One branch is strong, the other one is weak, in this sense?
No. So in the end, and I didn't bring this slide, we published a paper last year where we compared rats that had been raised in a standard living condition with ones that were raised in an enriched environment where they foraged for food and fought with their mates. And the pattern was different, okay? And I don't know, I may have a summary of it somewhere, but essentially what you see in the deprived animals is this condition here, where you have strong parents and weak daughters. In the enriched condition, you almost never saw that. Okay, that there were strong parents and that were paired with strong daughters, or there weren't strong parents at all then.
So there was no difference between the two daughter branches.
There, I mean, so yeah. So I was an overall generalization that we still could find that there were some cases where they were weak and strong, but generally they went more together.
So the reason for my question, I was trying to understand what would be the computational role or what would be the functional usefulness of having a weak branch.
Yeah. So I mean, it could receive different input that was never, that there wasn't a lot of experience of that input coming in and firing off that branch. It never really received a lot of incidences of this type spatial temporal correlated input. Okay. More likely, they should go together. I mean, I can see your point on that as well. And actually, once you get them under more natural conditions, they do tend to do that. This is an experimental protocol, no doubt about it. It's a sort of standard one.
Yeah, I know about it in terms of when you look at it on the large scale.
Yeah, the idea is it's supposed to mimic theta exploratory activity like state where pulses of inputs are coming in at 5 or 10 hertz, something like this, and that happens repetitively, in this case, as the animal runs through its place field back and forth. All the CA3 cells who have those same place fields are showing up on this branch. They're repetitively getting stimulated over and over again. That strengthens up that branch so that at night, when it's replayed during slow wave sleep, it can produce a strong spike that will fire an output that is precisely timed, and that everything can occur 20 times faster than it does then. That's my speculation about the function.
Jim, how do you know that the changes are in the branch where the P is rather than the branch where the D is rather than the branch where the P is?
Well, the P doesn't change. It's derivative after all of this. That's the only evidence we have. But this is variable as well, although most of them are strong. Not all of the mother-parent branches are strong. So there is some plasticity that's going on there as well.
Okay.
Yes.
So the D, I need to go considerable length into the branch again. And all the section would be the same? Or do you have patches? Or it would be homogeneous to the whole sub-branch?
Let me see if I find that. It doesn't really matter which spines you pick or where. You can go too far, okay, and then the thing won't propagate. You can cluster all your input at the very end of the cell, and then you'll get something different, okay? But for us, I mean, we think that wouldn't happen. That's less likely. It's more likely that, you know, you need 5% of these inputs or something on one of these branches, and that they would be fairly distributed in space. I mean, I know what context you're asking me that about. And it is true that the only time we get a regional difference is if we really cluster everything up very distal. I just want to show, this is just to remind me that this is branch specific, so we can cause it to happen on the B branch. But if we weren't giving the pairing protocol onto A, nothing happens to the excitability in this neighboring branch. Okay. Other people have seen this sort of thing with clustered synaptic input, and it tends to even be restricted to about 20 microns of a branch point. Okay, so whatever chemical signals involved in this won't come across these branches. There's some sort of MAP kinase, RAS, whatever signal that's generated by this activity, and it kind of diffuses around in the branch, and it actually does cause a change in the synaptic strength as well as the excitability of the branch, but it stays within that branch. In the plasticity, no. But to be honest, we haven't really examined the daughter sort of interaction very carefully, but that's where we would expect it to be, and we really haven't done that. Maybe we should. because it's kind of an interesting point that these local spikes could sort of group up one of these families all together, right? And they may not propagate well forward, but they'll propagate well enough within the families to regulate their, co-regulate their excitability. Okay, so yes, other people have looked at synaptic plasticity. Is that what you mean? This is different. This is basically, we're talking about an even finer scale localization. Okay, they're talking about distal, maybe tuft versus proximal. Although someone in Greg's lab did do, maybe there's a difference between LTP and the distal basals versus proximal basals. Are you sorry? Wait, so, but that causes, that was a bursting thing. That's not the same paper that I'm thinking about. They so some of these are induction mechanisms. Yeah. All right. This is finer scale. And the input is all pretty local, okay? They're talking about pairing with backpropagating spikes or bursts and things like this, and we did that as well. We don't even need spikes with this, backpropagating spikes. We do it with carbachol, which is, okay, you know, not the most physiological thing, but it should mimic at some level muscarinic activation, which should be present during this theta state as well. And then we can see this just as strongly there. Right, so this is branch strength plasticity, and it gives you some interesting features then. Since it is essentially only going to occur with this synchronous and clustered input, you know, if there's some feature that's being encoded in that, then this allows all these mechanisms, that's all this is, this allows you to store that higher order feature, this temporal, spatial-temporal correlation of that input. Okay, and if that feature was a specific receptive field, the repeated occurrence of that activation of that receptive field could be stored within the branch strain. Okay, so in the last little bit of time, before I go, so I should ask if there's any more questions on that. Okay. I'm going to try to focus on the sort of other class of dendritic nonlinearity, and that's this distal plateau potential and how it's generated, and then we're going to try to look for its occurrence in vivo to see if we can find a particular instance in the behaving animal's life when the plateau potential would be evoked and may be important. So just a little background, and I'll try to talk about, this is going to be true for both the CA1 cells and layer 5 cells. I know CA3 cells do it as well, and see the layer 2-3 cells, do they have, maybe. So there's enough difference between layer 5 cells version and CA1 cells version to cover this sort of a span of different cells. And so here's the deal, we can give input to a CA1 cell that's more proximal via the Schaefer collateral, this would be electrical stimulation. There'll be no inhibition here, it's all excitation. And in this case, we're recording from the distal part of the cell. And then we can stimulate another pathway, the perforant path, it's from the entorhinal cortex, and then image in here and record the voltage there. So action potentials generally don't backpropagate very well in these cells. It requires some distal depolarization, I already showed you that. If you depolarize the distal part of the cell, then they'll come back. You can do the same thing with real synaptic input. So if we stimulate the Schaefer's, then we have action potentials that are back propagating strongly into the distal part of the cell. The same thing is true in these cells for the most distal tuft input. They too can pull this action potential back in into the tuft so that you get strong back propagation and a large calcium signal. Now, if you just stimulate both of them together, the SLM and the Schaefer's, you can see that you reach action potential threshold, and then in CA1 cells, they're not as bursty for whatever reason, as a layer 5 cells, you have to do this repetitively. And if you do it repetitively, then you can start to kick off this distal plateau potential, which is widespread throughout basically the whole barbarization. Okay, so let's see what I have next here. The plateau potential initiation in these cells requires the coincident activation of these two inputs. You can get it with just the distal stimulation, but you have to give a really unrealistic amount of input, basically stimulating half of the inputs into the distal part of the cell. So to be more realistic, you can split that up between the two inputs, and then you just have the proximal input, and it essentially bringing the cell to threshold and causing some action potential output. Okay, so if you can get action potential output, full input from the perforant path, and then shift into this calcium plateau potential generation mode. You do the exact same experiment in the presence of TTX onto the soma, so that you're not getting any backpropagating spikes initiated. You get no plateau potential spiking. Okay, so it's this combination of these two inputs that are allowing backpropagating action potentials to come into the tuft, to sum there with the input and produce this plateau potential and then burst firing mode output. Basically the same thing happens in layer 5 cells. It's called backfiring. You get the proximal part of the cell to go off, action potential backpropagates. You pair that with some synaptic input, some current injection in this case, and it produces this calcium plateau potential and more spikes from the soma. Okay, so I think everyone would agree that this is more likely to happen, it's easier to happen in layer 5 cells and CA1 cells, but it's essentially the same components. Some proximal input that's causing the cell to go off, and that's mixing then with distal input to produce the calcium plateau potential. Now, one of my favorite sort of abstractions of what neurons do or can do is this comparator function, okay? And this is comparing either the timing or the amplitude or both of two inputs that are coming into the cell, okay? And we just pretty much saw a really good example of that, okay? If you have a temporal coincidence of enough proximal and distal input, then the cell will completely change its mode of integration and output. Okay, and I think if you sit down and think about it, whatever cell type you're really studying, this happens quite frequently. There's always two inputs. And in a lot of cases, it's an external representation, if you will, being compared to an internal representation. In the hippocampus, this is you know, for CA1 cell, this would be the input coming in from CA3, the stored representation of whatever this animal's running through in its environment, being compared with this direct input, this direct cortical input from the EC to the tuft, which isn't filtered through the hippocampus at all. Okay, in the neocortex, let's say a layer 5 cell, this could be the internal representation could be motor input into sensory to S1 regions. So if you're in the Whisker barrel cortex, it receives motor input from M1. And at the same time, it receives sort of bottom-up input from the thalamus about different sensation or different experience. And that this input and the correlation in time and in space in this cell is compared, and then some signal is produced, some error signal, if you will, is produced that may then modify this internal representation. Yes?
Could you elaborate
on that sense, this top-down inputs coming from other areas, and one, are an internal representation? Or an internal representation. So in this case, it would be the input from the motor cortex, okay, which is telling, okay, a lot of what I'm going to tell you is speculative, in fact, all of this is, that is telling the animal's whiskers to move, okay, move and find a bar in this case, if it's doing a whisker discrimination task. So the idea is that the amount of input from M1 that's coming into this region is going to depend on the whisking that you want the animal to whisk to actively sense, and then how much whisking or how far the whisking is being produced.
Should I think that you have a forward model?
Oh, so, okay, so, you know, this vocabulary I'm not very good with. It's too bad David's not here. He knows all of this. But it's like efferent copy, or it's a copy of the motor command that gets sent to the sensory. Yeah. There's another one. Now, the external is the external environment, the world. So that's the sensory. The internal is what's generated by the brain itself, in this case, the motor cortex.
So, what I was trying to understand, it wouldn't make any sense to compare the motor sensory. You can compare the actual sensory input with what you predict the sensory input would be given the motor action.
That's correct.
That would be a meaningful comparison.
That's correct. That's the way I think about it, and I think Jackie's got a different view on it.
Something which is circular. You need to have the motor command for the whisker to move. Right?
Yes.
Right.
But that is something that the animal, that is internally generated by the animal. That's the idea.
She
have an internal representation.
She's not whisking all the time. I mean, she chooses to whisk.
That's correct. That's what I mean. So let me try this. Maybe it's a little simpler for you in the hippocampus. So area CA3 produces some network of place fields, right? For any given place field, there'll be a set of CA3 cells that respond to that place field. Okay, and then that will come into CA1, and that'll be compared with input that's straight from the entorhinal cortex. Okay, that's a representation of the actual environment that's coming from the sensory cortices. So that's external, whereas you have this other representation that's generated by the external, but it's shaped by the interconnections amongst the network. Yes.
So in the case of backpropagation, people often invoke using that signal for spike time dependent plasticity.
But yeah.
But here, the function is totally different. You're not thinking about changing synapses. You're thinking about changing the firing of the cell. Is that correct? That,
in this case, but so, I mean, we've shown in the CA1 cells that once you get the plateau, it is a very strong inducer of plasticity. It's a huge calcium signal. And once you get that, then the perforant path input will potentiate up. Okay, so it's both. It's an internal signal that produces synaptic plasticity and probably dendritic plasticity, but as well it changes the firing mode to produce some sort of signal that's used, it's used by the rest of the network. I mean, you can make up all kinds of things that it's a feedback error signal to adjust this internal representation or whatever, but it changes the output mode. Yes?
So the idea
that
CA1 compared to the triangle
to a CA3
is sort of an old idea.
It is.
Your theory transcends that. It was just a CA3 because it was also an alpha. So
what
is that?
Yeah, you've called my bluff on that one. I can't really do as well on this. I mean, it's two different regions of the entorhinal cortex. And this is kind of where, at some point, all these models, theories really fall apart, okay? And this is where mine does for the hippocampus, because CA1 gets input from entorhinal layer 3, and CA3 gets it from layer 2. And it isn't clear at all that that's the same information coming in to the two different regions. And so I couldn't say that it's the same sort of comparison, but again, you know, that input then somehow would that output from CA3 would somehow modify the internal representation. So it already did one comparison, and then that modifies the internal representation that's going to the CA1. So basically the answer is I'm not sure how it applies to CO2. But it is very different, okay, because it's two different regions. With the idea being that it's the same information, though.
Doesn't the CA3 region have to get new inputs in order to store a new pattern? So it makes sense to have that.
I mean, we'll get a little bit off track here, but maybe it'll help. For all of these networks, they sort of have an input region. In this case, it's a dentate gyrus, right? And what comes out of that is a sparsification of the input, so that only a few dentate cells are going to fire, and then those are going to send out these very strong moxie fiber inputs, and they're going to pull out little seeds of a representation of an ensemble in CA3. And then the interconnections, the strong interconnections in CA3 will strengthen that up, and the whole population will go off in some sort of synchronous fashion over whatever, 100 milliseconds. So somehow that is compared with a direct representation from the exact input that fired off the dentate cells to begin with. Okay, and so again, you're comparing the internal representation that the dentate produced with this external EC input. And then it happens again down in CA1, but with a different inferential area. And that's where everything sort of falls apart. It needs to be the same kind of area, at least the same information. So I think a very similar thing happens in layer 4 as far as this potential sparsification in the input region. Actually, in both of those two regions, the cells, the dendrites, are really strikingly linear. For whatever reason. Okay, so we wanted to try to look at this a little bit closer and in vivo. So, in layer 5 cell, this is going to be a coarse sort of reproduction of what was going on before. We're going to just inject current straight into the tuft, just before the tuft, into the trunk, and produce the calcium plateau with just a current injection. This is to sort of mimic a lot of something that's already happened. There's a lot of backpropagating spikes with some local input that caused this plateau potential calcium spike to be reached. Okay, and then we're going to look at what happens as it propagates back into the tree. And so it's pretty remarkable that even this broad 50-100 millisecond long plateau potential can really only propagate out a couple of branch orders, and then it doesn't make it into the distal arbor at all. Again, this fits with this idea that you need this top-down input to be there to allow the whole calcium plateau potential to innervate or depolarize the tuft. And so we've tried to recreate that by uncaging, again, putting a glutamate onto a distal branch and imaging at the same time. And now we can see when we do this simultaneously, we give the uncaging with the plateau potential. We can now get a calcium signal out in the distal part of the cell. So instead of dropping off, it stays fairly constant. So it is correct, the idea that you still need a distal input into the tufts of layer 5 cells to even get this calcium spike.
Exactly, what's the preparation?
This is a layer, this is a rat, no, this is a rat slice from the barrel cortex of a 6-week-old animal.
So how much depolarization do you have with
the uncaging? It's not enough to fire off the branch, but it's only a few millivolts here, okay? So here's another example of a just sub-threshold, probably a 30 millivolt depolarization right here that shows up tenfold attenuated there.
30 millivolts there?
Probably. And so I'm just, you know, basing on what the threshold would be for local spike initiation. So there's, yes, there's this thing causes no calcium signal because it's just sub-threshold. It's set that way. One more input would have caused it to go off, but it doesn't. We just turn it down just below threshold, so it's 20, 30 millivolts worth of depolarization locally that is extremely attenuated by the time it gets here, but if you put them together, like I was saying, I think one way to think of this is that pulls the calcium plateau back into the dendrite. It allows it to back propagate better, or that they both sort of decrement, and then where they come together in sum, then you can get a local depolarization. Either way, you put the two together, then you can get a large calcium signal, large depolarization all the way out to the distalmost parts of these cells. And for us, that is required. Maybe that's a stronger requirement, or not a stronger requirement in other people's hands. Okay, so now we want to see in these same, if we want to look at the distal cup of these same cells to see if we can find calcium signals which look something like what we've seen in our slice experiments. We have a mouse in a tube that's head fixed. Here's the head fixed bars. There's a window on his skull. We have a two photon microscope above it. The neocortical cells are injected with an AAV virus that expresses this genetically encoded calcium indicator called GCAMP3. It's slow and low affinity, probably like, for those that know anything about this, OGB6F, micromolar kinds of affinities. We're going to target this in a way that basically we bias our recording samples from layer 5 cells. Then we're going to attempt to recreate the cells in the end to make sure we know what kind of cell it was. We'll do high-speed imaging of trimmed whiskers simultaneously, and as you'll see, a pole is going to come up in different positions, and they're going to have to whisk and find it. If they're able to find it and get a touch, then they should lick for a reward right here. If they don't find it, if it's too far out of their field, they're not supposed to whisk. They're not supposed to drink. Okay, and here's an example of a whisking field, and we can actually see dendrites and spines and branches and things like that. This is right at the surface of the cortex, about within 50 microns of the surface. All the data I'm going to show you is from a single cell. All of these branches are from one cell. This is what it looks like. Light comes on. The bar comes up into the whisker field. If it's in the right position, she'll lick. And if it's not, she's supposed to hold her tongue. About 90% behavioral accuracy. And we're just going to look and see, okay, can we get calcium signals in here or not? The idea is that this whisking, causing them to have to actively sense, to actively whisk, is providing a motor input to the layer 1, to the tuft, and that the pole touching the whisker is the bottom-up input, the sensation, where they're combined in cells together, we should have this calcium plateau, and it should show up as a large, prolonged calcium signal.
How do you know the robot pizza from the same cell?
I'll show you. So if we just take image stats, we can recreate the cell. And that's here. This is what we get. So all of those branches fed down to one single trunk. What we don't have is the more distal, at the surface, branches. So this thing would even spread out even further because it went out of the field of the imaging. Oh,
crap. Look at tiny. Wow, that's never happened.
Thank you. Okay. The pole is going to be in five positions, and this is a very simple task. A lot of people don't agree that this is even a behavior, but basically all it is the pole is going to come up in one of these positions, and they're close enough to the whiskers that a touch can be made, and the red one is so far away that they can't touch it, even if they whisk as far as they can. And so based upon that, he or she should correctly reject if it's in the red, or lick if it's in one of these other four pole positions. Okay, and you can see the whisking pattern. It's pretty interesting, actually. Before the pole comes up, you'll see the pole come into focus, get bigger, there you go, and it's whisking, and then finds it, and then it kind of brings his whiskers in that position. You can see that here. Here's the whisking trace. Big amplitude protractions and retractions initially, and then the black lines are the touches, okay, and eventually it starts to touch it, and then the calcium signal from this branch right here goes off like this. One of the things you can see from the imaging just by eye is that the whole cell, the whole arbor goes off together. Okay, and if I showed you all of those different regions, they would look very similar to this. Sometimes we can see a little bit smaller, a little bit kinetic differences, but basically, you almost see it by eye. We're all going off.
Speaking at the same time,
she has to hold her tongue. She's supposed to until the bar comes up, and then once the bar comes up, she can drink at any time. That's what all. I know it's impossible to see, but that's what all these pink tips are. So what we see is when there's no touch, there's no signal. Okay, and that's shown here. And you know, if you wanted to, you could say there's a behavioral correlation to the calcium plateau because of that. Okay? If there's a correct rejection where there's no touch and there's no licking, there's no plateau potential that's initiated. At minimum, you can say that there's no plateau. There's a plateau potential generated only when there's both whisking and a touch. Okay, if there's just whisking and no touch, we get no signal. And I don't show you here. If you just touch the whiskers, like an anesthetized animal, or if you do something that you just touch and they don't whisk, which happens sometimes, then you don't see the plateau potential either. So it takes a correlation of these two inputs, these two stimuli, and we would bring that down to the two different inputs, the thalamic input, the proximal, and the distal motor input. Of course, that's a hypothesis, and we need to prove that. Oh yeah, so that's a really tough one. I mean, this is hard enough as it is, and so to you know, to kind of tease apart these two inputs will be next and a challenge for us. What's the reason? So we can tell, so there's a whole lot of other analysis to this, and you can tell that the whiskers or the cells are sensitive for either protractions or retractions, and you can compare the amplitude of the whisking that's required to get to that. You can see that this cell, and this shows up a lot actually, the larger the amplitude whisk, these pole positions up here, that were associated with a touch produced the calcium signal more frequently than the small ones. And so then you can really get carried away with your servo control mechanism, that the amplitude of the error signal is associated with where the whisker wants to be. If it's further away, and then you're going to get a bigger error signal out of the cell. But who knows? Okay, that's it.
incidence is you see the calves in the plateau when the animal is touching the bars.
Yes.
But at the same time, the moment the animals are touching the bars, they start drinking and getting a reward. And isn't that a possible compound for what is causing?
The reward signal. Okay, so now you're into the what is the layer one input, I guess.
Are there endocrine?
There are certainly a lot of other things. There's inputs from other cortical areas and modulatory inputs, which we'll all have to tease all of those apart, I guess. And that just not necessarily from the dendritic question point of view, but from the more functional point of view. Yes.
And the hips can kind of
Oh, that's an interesting analysis that we haven't done. I'll have a look at that.
To test the reward hypothesis, can't you like play with the animal but not give the reward when they're expected? Something like that, and then you would see if the plateau changes.
Yeah,
I mean, you would.
Yeah, you would untrain them, but I mean that would be the end of it. At the end of the experiment. I mean, I have to say, this being primary sensory cortices, my bias is that it's something more like motor than reward, but who knows, right? So, if you were in another region like the prefrontal cortex, you would say, oh, well, it's probably reward more than anything direct. So, yes, those are the future issues. Those cells usually die if you have a significant amount of dendrite cut off. Now you can cut off, I guess, a little bit of the branches, the terminal branches, but then, we really try to stay away from the surface cells anyway. So that will change the sort of, capacitive load of the cell, but not substantially, since most of those are pretty local anyway. I mean, it's true that there's a, you could change, there could be some effects, but they should be pretty minor, and you should try to avoid them by staying deep. So the mapping that's been done, in particular in the Svoboda lab, doesn't have a lot of direct sensory input or any sensory input going into layer four. I think there's some controversy about that, about a less direct thalamic input from PO, called, that may show up. It at least has axons up there, but they don't seem to make contact with the layer five cells. So that's the idea, is that the vast majority of the sensory input should be perisomatic, whereas whatever's coming into layer one, it may not be motor, and that's a fact. It could be something else more subtle, or just some other cortical input that isn't motor. But there's a strong motor M1 cortex input in layer one and S1. It's quite pronounced. So it's the best guess. And it fits with the hypothesis.
Your calcium activation,
we've shown it in the slides. But not in vivo, no. So you're asking what experiment I'm going to do next, and there aren't really any good choices. There's several hard ones, and we'll try to go through all of those. And that's somehow it's silencing the input without changing the output of the motor cortex. Right, and if you've got a good idea and you're willing to hear it. I mean, the best way to do it would be to silence, halo or something, the axons. But it is not guaranteed, and it's probably not likely that you can just silence the axons, right? Probably, at best, could hope to reduce probability of release or something like that. Yes, I mean, so it's not so easy to apply things locally. I mean, Dura is still intact. It's a very intact prep, and the whole prep quality goes to hell once you start putting holes in the Dura and stuff. So we'd have to come up with a way to regionally apply a drug, which, you know, isn't very clean either. So anything you do just sort of grossly to the motor cortex is going to change this whisking pattern, and then that's, you know, you're in a bad cycle then. And so, I mean, that's the hammer, and we'll do that and see what happens for sure, but it won't be a clean answer. If it doesn't do anything, right? I mean, I think that sounds plausible, right? But I don't know how to do that, because anytime anything happens, they whisk. And so if you started them whisking, then they'd try to take over, and then I don't know what that would result in. Well, yeah, so that's right. So some sort of peripheral intervention, including like maybe, you know, poisoning the nerve, but then I believe the nerve is mixed, sensory and motor, and so we're working on these things. Of course, there's no clean way to do it that we've come up with yet, but you know, maybe there'll be a genetic twist. We can just hit the sensory cells and silence them or activate them, and at least test that part of the theory.
Thank you.